What's the prospect for a Green New Deal in the Biden administration?
I think that even if Joe Biden doesn't integrate all of the Green New Deal's policies, it certainly seems like he is integrating the broad principles of a Green New Deal, which is we need to use the levers of the federal government to transform the economy.
That's Guido Girgenti. We talk with him about the book he co-edited with the Sunrise Movement's Varshini Prakash, Winning the Green New Deal. Then we talk with wildlife photographer Ian Shive about his stunning book of photos and essays about America's wildlife refuges. It's called Refuge, America's Wildest Places. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. In Joe Biden's inauguration speech on January 20th, he promised bold action on the climate crisis. He's learned a lot since the Democratic primary, when his climate plan got a D rating from climate activists. But now they're cautiously optimistic that Biden understands the scale and urgency of what it will take to tackle the issue. One of the key figures who got Biden up to speed on climate is Varshini Prakash, leader of the Sunrise Movement. She and my guest Guido Girgenti are co-editors of the new book, Winning the Green New Deal. It's a collection of essays from leaders and experts about the Green New Deal and a detailed playbook for how we can win it. Guido Girgenti is the media director for Justice Democrats and a founding board member of the Sunrise Movement. He's also host of the podcast Block Party. That's B-L-O-C, Party. Guido Girgenti, welcome to Writer's Voice. Winning the Green New Deal, this is really a terrific book for anyone who wants to understand the Green New Deal and also the political implementation of it, let's say, the political strategy around getting it done. It starts with a reference to the school strike for climate. I was there in New York City when that happened. It was one of the most astonishing demonstrations I've ever been to. There were so many young people. Were you there?
I was. I was working on the book at that point. So I was with Sunrise following along the stories coming in from New Zealand and from Europe. And I had also been working with Varshini on the speech that she gave that day.
For just as long, the wealthy and the powerful have profited off of pollution, have lied to millions of people about the science, have choked our democracy with their big oil dollars and stolen our futures. Today, this generation is taking over.
Which was an interesting speech just about, I think it was a moment where we were on the one hand just awestruck by the size of the crowds across the world. And just seeing how many young people were willing to take action around the issue of climate change. But also there's a part of Varshini's speech where she says, you know, even this is probably not enough to shift government policy as fast and as drastically as we need to prevent catastrophic climate change. So I always remember that moment as one of many moments in the struggle to avert the worst of climate change, where we make an immense leap forward and yet still have so far to go.
And so little time to do it in. So the first essay in the book, The Green New Deal, Why We Must and How We Can, the first essay is by David Wallace Wells, who is the author of The Uninhabitable Earth. And he opens with the crisis as it is here and now, you know, not sometime in the future, but now. We don't have a lot of time to go over the crisis because I really want to focus this interview on, you know, the political change needed to make the Green New Deal happen. But I would like you to explain our carbon budget, what that means, and how much time we have to spend it.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the way to think about the carbon budget is – planet Earth has reserves of fossil fuels in the ground, oil, coal, that we can dig up and burn, which is what the fossil industry would like to keep doing for as long as possible. And then when we burn that, carbon goes into the atmosphere, right? And scientists are trying to measure, you know, at what point have you put so much carbon in the atmosphere that the Earth is going to surpass an average of 2 degrees Celsius of warming, no matter what happens after that point, right? You reach a point of no return. So the carbon budget is a way to think about, okay, how much coal, oil, gas can we still extract and burn without exceeding the amount of carbon that will push us into a world that's on average 2 degrees hotter than it was before the Industrial Revolution, which is the safe threshold. It's actually not that safe of a threshold, but it's what we're trying to keep the world below. So the carbon budget is the estimation for how much fossil fuels you can still burn. Now, the numbers are changing, but the one that has always stuck in my mind when the carbon budget burst onto the scene was Bill McKibben, all the way back in 2013, put this budget on the table saying that the fossil industry has 5 times the amount of carbon in their reserves than scientists say is safe to burn. So even 7 years ago, we are at the point where we knew that we needed to leave around maybe 80% of fossil fuels. We need to leave them in the ground. And obviously, since then, our carbon budget has gotten smaller because we've continued to burn fossil fuels. The other number that I'll add that I like to think about is last year, the UN put out a emissions gap report where they estimated how much do you need to ramp down emissions each year to try to avert 2 degrees of warming. So that's a slightly different way to conceive of the problem than the carbon budget, but just giving you an annual target for ramping down emissions. And they found that countries like the US, who emit a lot of fossil fuels and have a lot of technological prowess to transition away, need to do a 7.6% reduction in annual emissions every year for a decade. To put that into context, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, when the economy collapsed as the Soviet Union fell apart, they experienced a 5% drop in emissions that year. And this is a year when, you know, thousands of acres of farmland was abandoned, factories were left at a standstill. So it just gives you a sense of the immense economic transformation that is now required to avert the worst of climate change because we have waited so long to start the difficult work.
And the work is difficult, but there's a wonderful sentence in this book, and it might have been your co-author, Varshini Prakash, who wrote it. I'm not sure, but nearly everything that is broken or brutal about the world today will be made worse by climate change if we don't stop it. And nearly everything that is good can be made better through decarbonization. So talk about the latter. I mean, this transition, this difficult transition, can get us to a place that's much better in many ways, not just about climate change.
Absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, think about how much we already sacrifice to an economy that is driven by fossil fuels. So many communities around the country, especially Black communities, Latino communities, immigrant communities, and poor communities, live with higher rates of asthma, live with higher rates of cancer, because they live near an incinerator, they live near a coal plant, they live near a fracking well, but also the world that we are creating today, where Houston experiences once in a century storms multiple times in one decade. When we do the work of mitigating climate change, we both ramp down the extraction and production of a fuel that is poisoning us and poisoning the workers who have to extract it and poisoning our oceans when drilling rigs like the Deepwater Horizon explode. we are ending an economy that sacrifices so much of this beautiful planet and people's lives to the chemicals and the poison of those fuels. But when we do the work of also preparing to take care of each other in a climate-changed world, we end up doing the world of building more resilient societies, of building societies where we have public housing that is resilient to hurricanes like Hurricane Sandy in New York, and of providing unemployed Americans with good jobs, restoring wetlands, or building clean energy. And you realize that so many of the things that need to get done to prevent the worst of catastrophe can also fulfill deep needs in our lives, both the need to live and play and grow in a society with clean water and clean air and clean land, but also the need to have a fulfilling job and a dignified job that doesn't harm our neighbors and harm our planet, but allows us to take part in a collective project of building a humane society that can withstand the fires and the floods that are still going to come, unfortunately, because of the climate change and the global warming that we've already locked in the past century.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually think it might have been Naomi Klein who wrote that sentence, because she writes about market fundamentalism. And, you know, what you say, it just is really underscored by the notion that we are sacrificing, so many people are sacrificing so much for the profit of just a very, very few people.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that provides... I think when people ask, you know, how is it possible to win in this struggle? And it would be different if we were living in this fossil fueled economy, but for whatever reason, there really was some broadly shared prosperity that was coming out of the fossil industry. But it's not. I mean, we know we live in a society where inequality is rising. So many Americans live paycheck to paycheck. So many Americans, even if they do have a stable income, just feel this sense of deep economic insecurity that at any moment they could lose their job and then they could lose their health care. And meanwhile, you have a few captains of industry who are wealthier than are some of the wealthiest people to have ever lived in the history of money, in the history of human civilization, who want us to keep digging up these fuels and burning them and driving us into a much more brutal planet. And I think that actually provides a political opportunity to unite broad, broad majorities around this change. It's obviously a challenge there, given the current state of the Republican Party, and I think the disinformation bubble and you know, the separate reality that right-wing media has constructed. But I think despite that, there are millions of people who I think can see their own hopes and dreams and aspirations for their own lives in this vision of transforming society away from fossil fuels. And I think that's a political opportunity that we need to make sure we seize.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Guido Girgenti. He is the co-author of Winning the Green New Deal, Why We Must, How We Can. And his co-author is Varshini Prakash. Yeah, so let's talk about how to build that political... You talk about a new political alignment. And you are also the media director for Justice Democrats, which has put forth, you know, some of the most successful new progressives that have been able to been elected to Congress, including AOC and Jamal Bowman and others, and Cori Bush, who is just a phenomenal person. So talk about what you mean by a political alignment, how to build the kind of broad coalition that is necessary to get political power to make the changes that we need for the Green New Deal.
Yeah. So this is a way of understanding the twists and turns in American political history that political scientists and historians have debated for half a century now. I don't necessarily get into the weeds of that debate, but the big picture idea is that some elections obviously matter much more than others in American history, and some elections are these real ideological political turning points. So the 1932 election of FDR, we look back at that as obviously the beginning of the New Deal era, but what that means to begin a new era of American politics, I think, is really important for us, for those of us who want to change history today, to look back at. Because what happens in that moment is, it's not just that FDR wins in a landslide, but that through his victory, he indicts and discredits the Gilded Age ideology that had dominated American politics and that the Republican Party had really stuck to for half a century, ending with Herbert Hoover's refusal to do more to end the suffering in the Great Depression. And over the course of implementing the New Deal and over the course of the movements that rise up in that moment, obviously the labor movement, but also the seeds of what would become the civil rights movement, African Americans organizing in unions in the North, there is a new political coalition that comes into being, that comes to dominate politics, the New Deal coalition. It's not a perfect coalition. It includes the Jim Crow South, and concessions are made to the Jim Crow South that ultimately, I think, doom the coalition in the 1970s. But for the next generation, in the mid-20th century, American politics is really defined by the policy consensus that comes out of the New Deal. And when you go back to a GOP-run White House, when Eisenhower is elected in the 1950s, Eisenhower says, look, no political party can dismantle the New Deal. No one can repeal Social Security. No one can repeal the farms and labor programs. Those are just part of American politics now, part of the American economy. And I think that is the level of transformation that we need to aspire to, not trying to solve this problem within the ideological constraints that are placed on us by the free market fundamentalism that I think has been dominant in politics since the Reagan Revolution of 1980, which is the next major realignment after 1932. Although arguably that realignment begins in the 1960s with what's called the Civil Rights Realignment, when the Democratic South begins to shift Republican. So I think today the question is, can there be a realignment that in its scope and in its scale rivals FDR's win in 1932, rivals the beginning of the New Deal era, and perhaps rivals the Reagan Revolution of 1980? I think we don't know the answer to that question, and I think it's very possible that partisan polarization, the intensity of the attachment that voters have to Team Blue and Team Red, makes it much more difficult to shift voting coalitions around in the way that we saw, you know, particularly in the New Deal. At the same time, I think there's a real similarity between what happened in the 1930s and the 1980s and now, which is that the reigning consensus of the previous era, I think, is quite unpopular and discredited, right? Today, I don't think that shrink the government is the problem, is really the leading frame of American politics in the way that it was in the Reagan and Clinton era, and even in the first part of the Obama era. So it's really an open question of history right now that we don't know which way it will go. But I think we have to aspire to be part of a realignment of that scale, because I think that will open the door to the transformations needed to create a fossil-free economy.
Yeah, and there are a couple of threads there I'd like to pick up on. I mean, you're right. I think that the mood has shifted. COVID-19 has probably done a good bit to show people why government is important. But even so, I mean, even before COVID-19, 67% of Americans were in support of the Green New Deal. It's probably even more so now. We saw Florida where people were, you know, 70% of them wanted Medicare for all, and yet Trump still won Florida. I guess my question is, How do you create this kind of democratic change in an oligarchy? Not that it can't be done, but how do you apply the levers to shift, to make the fundamental shift in the time that we have to do it?
Well, I think that is the million-dollar question. But I think part of the answer that is threaded throughout the book is it's important to build movements that are nimble enough and I think sophisticated enough to be swimming in and out of the currents of both government politics and electoral politics and the work of mass movement building and mass protest. And it's a difficult balancing act, and I don't want to pretend that it's easy, but I think the project of the Sunrise Movement, and I think, you know, the Sunrise Movement is learning from some of the innovations of the Movement for Black Lives and the Dreamers in the Obama era, is the ability to both primary corporate Democrats and oust the worst of the Democratic Party and elect champions like AOC, but also be able to pull off mass strikes, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, and also to be able to be supporting and developing a new policy consensus around the Green New Deal in a variety of progressive think tanks, while at the same time having our eyes set on this broader realignment and looking for opportunities to cohere a majority that's much bigger than any one movement could ever be. It's hard to balance all those goals, but the more that we build organizations that can move nimbly between those different terrains of struggle, I think the more successful we will be. And I think, you know, I don't think there's any silver bullet, but I think that we always have to be open to the possibility that things could actually change much, much faster than we imagine. You know, no one expected AOC to defeat Joe Crowley in a New York primary in summer 2018. And after she won, no one expected that 200 young people demanding a Green New Deal would show up with AOC at Speaker Pelosi's office a week after Democrats win back the House of Representatives. And it wasn't just those two events, but events like that obviously catapulted the Green New Deal forward onto the national agenda. And I think we just always have to be on the lookout for opportunities like that, when bringing together the power of movements and the power of progressive champions in Congress can really shoot us forward, perhaps further than we might imagine, given how bleak politics can feel, as you say, in an oligarchy.
So now let's go to national politics. When Joe Biden was, you know, before he won the nomination, his climate plan, I think, garnered a D. Trump's was an F, but Biden's was a D. And then after he won the nomination, there was your co-author, Varshini Prakash, I believe, was in the task force. It was put together by Bernie and Biden to talk about climate. And he came out with something that is not the Green New Deal in name, but has many of its ambitious goals and targets. So, you know, what do you feel about that process? Do you feel that the climate movement, in fact, helped to elect Joe Biden? And if so, how do we make sure that he fulfills on his promises to it?
I do think that the climate movement helped to elect Joe Biden. I think youth turnout was up in 2020. And given just the rise in turnout across the political spectrum and some of the slim margins in states like Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, having, you know, thousands more, tens of thousands more, hundreds of thousands of more young people turn out, and for many of whom climate is a top three issue or even the top issue, bringing them out to the polls. And I think that the climate movement putting something like the Green New Deal on the national agenda is essential to that happening. I think in terms of holding him accountable, I think we have to see the policies that get negotiated at the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force that, as you mentioned, AOC and Varshini were part of the climate working group there. You know, I think we need to see that as a victory, but also in many ways as still in the first part of a negotiation. It's a way that the Biden campaign going into the general election, but coming out of a primary where Bernie Sanders, despite losing, does quite well. Many young people vote for Bernie. Biden says, look, I'm integrating some of your policies, but not all of them. I think perhaps even more importantly than any one policy, although some people might disagree with me, is that I think that even if Joe Biden doesn't integrate all of the Green New Deal's policies, it certainly seems like he is integrating the broad principles of a Green New Deal, which is we need to use the levers of the federal government to transform the economy through investment, through regulations, through ramping down fossil fuel production. He doesn't include all those specific policies, but in a commitment to make the power sector fossil free, net zero by 2035, right? He's putting a policy on the table that is going to require a government-led transformation. And I think that's the opening that we need to seize now. And I think, again, this goes back to what I talk about being able to nimbly move between the worlds of movements and politics. There was a negotiation in the summer. There was a general election. Now Joe Biden will enter the White House. We don't know what will happen in Georgia, but I think the movement, again, needs to be prepared for the kind of strikes, the kind of protest, the kind of challenges to corporate Democrats that were part of the strategy from 2018 to 2020. It's obviously an unprecedented time because I think if there was not this global pandemic, we would see a lot of that out in the streets perhaps already. I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the Biden administration after there is a vaccine. I think we may see some of the biggest protests of the past decade, but I don't want to promise anything before the organizing has been done.
You don't think people will go to sleep like they did after Obama was elected?
No, I really don't. And after the election, we launched a radio show at Justice Democrats because, like you, we think this is a great medium to talk about politics. We've only done a few episodes, but one of the first things we've talked about is this moment really different from the winter of 2008? And there are ways that it is similar, but it is quite different, I think, just already to see the level of criticism that progressives are willing to levy at some of the worst of Joe Biden's cabinet. Not picks, but some of the people he's floated, like Rahm Emanuel, like Bruce Reed. Doesn't mean that the cabinet is perfect in any sense of the word, but I think you're seeing this willingness. There, I don't think there is any honeymoon between the left and the Democratic establishment. So I do think it will be different.
And I guess I just have to ask this last question because I lived in Massachusetts for many years. John Kerry was my senator. I was not impressed by, you know, his negotiation of the Paris Agreement. I mean, yes, it was a step forward, but there was a lot of ways in which he tried to slow down the progress, which I think a lot of people who are not in the climate movement didn't know. Do you think that he's moved on climate? And how do you feel about him as a pick for the climate czar, I guess? I don't remember the exact title he has.
The special climate envoy. It's a great question. I think I talked with Bernie Sanders' senior foreign policy advisor this week, and he said it's putting aside John Kerry's personal politics, announcing a international position of special climate envoy with John Kerry, a former Secretary of State, alongside the other top level national security picks, I think at a minimum tells you that Joe Biden is placing climate change not just at the top of his domestic agenda, but at the center of his administration from both domestic and foreign policy. So in terms of issue prioritization, it's great news. In terms of how Kerry has changed, I can't speak to that directly. I think we may not know. We'll have to see how he acts. He has launched this new initiative, World War Zero, which on the one hand, you could say it's great to see more figures in the mainstream of the Democratic Party embracing a policy framework that says we need a World War II level economic mobilization to stop climate change. That is the kind of policy we need to aspire towards. I think that that coalition that he's created has a political strategy, at least the way I've heard him talk about it, that's more, there's still a bipartisan consensus that can be cohered around some of these policies. And I think that is maybe where there's more of a sticking point where Democrats get themselves into a strategy of, well, where are we going to pre-compromise, sort of preemptively offer the GOP some concessions? I'm not saying that is what Kerry has done already in this position, but I think some of the language of his organization this past year, I could see it justifying that kind of strategy. I think that is where you might see criticism initially from the Sunrise Movement and from the left saying, look at the GOP right now. They are trying to discredit the election result. This is not a legitimate governing partner in a democracy. You should not pre-compromise on the climate crisis to make them happy because they are not good faith negotiating partners. We should just take the case to the American people and try to build political support and put them on the back foot for stalling on this crisis and for stalling on creating millions of good jobs. So I don't think we know whether or not the Biden administration will take that kind of tack, but they could, and it is certainly what we will be demanding of them over the next few months.
That's great, because it's what the science demands.
Yes, that's right.
If you go over the cliff at 40 miles an hour, it's no better than going over the cliff at 60 miles per hour.
Right. And that's why I brought up, you know, the UN saying, hey, you need to decarbonize, you need to ramp down emissions by 7.6% a year. And if you want some comparison, Guido's reminding you that when the Soviet Union collapsed, that was only a 5% reduction. That's not to say that we need the economy to collapse. It's just to say, if we are really going to not live in a world ravaged by famine, drought, storms, we need an intentional process that transforms the economy. And the only institution that has the power to do that in a humane and democratic way is a federal government that works for the people. That is what we need to do. That is how we can solve the problem that the science is presenting to us. And we need to start from that insight.
Well, Guido Girgenti, it has really been such a privilege to talk with you today about the book you co-authored with Varshini Prakash, Winning the Green New Deal. Thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Guido Girgenti. To hear an audio excerpt from Winning the Green New Deal, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, America's Wildlife Refuges. Stay tuned. After the break.
We have 12 years to radically transform our economy and our society to stop this crisis and protect human civilization as we know it. We'll talk about it like that because that's what it is.
That was Varshini Prakash talking at the Sunrise Movement sit-in outside Nancy Pelosi's office in 2018. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. The Trump regime, that thankfully is over, mounted an unprecedented assault on America's environment, including on its wildlife refuges. In the waning weeks of the regime, Trump opened perhaps the most important of those refuges, the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, to oil and gas drilling. My guest, wildlife photographer Ian Shive, has been photographing America's wilderness for decades for some of the nation's most prestigious magazines like National Geographic and Outside. His new book, Refuge, America's Wildest Places, is a stunning coffee table book of his photos of the nation's wildlife refuges with essays from scientists and conservationists from U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Welcome, Ian Shive, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Ian Shive, this book, Refuge, America's Wildest Places, is stunningly beautiful. And it contains a number of wonderful essays about the National Wildlife Refuge System and your amazing photographs. Just briefly tell us about how you became a wildlife photographer.
You know, I think it's like many, probably all careers in many ways. It's a journey, and it's evolved over almost two decades. I actually had a normal job in, I wouldn't exactly call it normal, but a job in corporate America, working in the movie industry. It was a really great experience. And I was doing that for almost a decade before I struck out on my own as a nature photographer. And I think what had happened is during that time in my career, I really realized that I was finding solace in nature on weekends, and that feeling I was getting kept growing and growing and growing. And I wanted to share it with people. And so my photography began developing. And so eventually I decided to take a leap and change careers. I felt that I was in a good enough position as a photographer at that time to do so, and left to become an assignment photographer working for many publications in the nature conservation space. You know, the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club, the National Park Conservation Association. I was on assignment for all of those, National Geographic. So I kind of continued to build through that, but my strength had always been sort of the crown jewels of nature, if you will, or at least as I thought of them then, and that was the national parks. And it was like, if you're going to do great nature and you want to do great nature photography, the national parks are the place to go. And so for almost, the first half, I'd say, of my photography career, 9 years or so, that's all I really focused on, was traveling to all the different states and all the different national parks, and did a couple books on those national parks as well. But then it came to my attention that the National Wildlife Refuge System was there, and it sort of lives in the shadow of the national park system. And so that became an 8-year relationship as a photographer and filmmaker. And so it's really been this evolution of somebody who started small, started local, but just, I've always found passion in our public land and water system. And, you know, whether I have a camera or not, it's one of the places I'm the most comfortable. And being able to bring those together, kind of go through this evolution of seeing, you know, how much tremendous value our public land and water system has really just compelled me further and further into the exploration of those places.
What's the difference between a national wildlife refuge? You know, what is so different about them from national parks and the national forests?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a constant struggle for the average person to know the difference between a national park, a national forest, a national wildlife refuge, a state park. There's BLM. There's all these different federal and state designations of how we've put land aside. And in each of those comes with different rules or, you know, levels of protection, you know, and even within all of those, there's other overlapping designations like national monuments and marine national monuments, and even the Wilderness Act, which designates wilderness areas, which may even be inside a national park or a national wildlife refuge. So it's very easy to get confused by it. But the big difference, I would say, is the national park system is the iconic system put aside for future generations. And it's really the genesis of protecting places in our government system. And from there, we added the National Wildlife Refuge System, which was not just to protect for future generations, but looking at the protection of wildlife first. And so that became the very big distinction. But on the surface, there's another really large distinction. The national park system is only approximately, and I say only, it's obviously a large amount, but about 85 million acres of land. The National Wildlife Refuge System is 115 million acres of land and an additional approximately 700 million acres of ocean that are within that system. So you have a system that is literally the largest network of public lands and waters in the world. But the National Park Service has really had the benefit of being more known. You know, it's had the icons, the El Capitan and Half Domes and Old Faithful and Delicate Arch and the Grand Canyon. And really from almost the get-go and the beginning of artists like Thomas Moran really captured the imaginations of people. And the National Wildlife Refuge System didn't quite have that same, lack of a better phrase, almost marketing program. It lacked the opportunity to quickly become part of that. And I think why the parks did so well initially is because and why they were protected is because they are so radically different from the area around them. And you look at a place like Yellowstone and the geyser basin and everything. And the refuge system is different. Even though it's larger, in many ways I found it to be almost wilder. You know, I found that because it didn't have as much traffic and many of them, you know, even some of the largest ones are, you know, are only accessible from a road. But in order to experience the 99.9% of hundreds of thousands of acres, you have to get out on foot or on ski or snowmobile or, you know, whatever it is to really get in there and genuinely spend, you know, weeks at a time to even get to one small corner of them. And so they're different in that sense, too, in that they, you know, and they have their, you know, they have their geysers and their volcanoes and their, you know, really magnificent places. But I think that they're almost in a way, almost a bit wilder and a bit more away from the throngs of people that have really, you know, become enamored with the national park system, especially now in the modern age and in the age of the pandemic.
You say wild, and you ask the question in this book, Ian Shive, In Refuge, America's Wildest Places. You ask, what does it mean to be wild? So tell us your thoughts on that question.
So for me, I think wild really boils down to getting out of a comfort zone, perhaps to some degree, or perhaps just feeling that you're connected to nature. You know, I think maybe that's ultimately the best definition of wild, is that you're far enough from the distractions of our modern lives that we feel like we have a connection with nature. And I think that could even happen in our own backyards, even a vegetable garden, potentially.
Well, that's true. And I think that's a lovely way to frame that. And then there is actually a legal definition of wilderness that I found pretty interesting, which is in the act, I guess, that established the National Wildlife Refuge System. And there's an essay you have by Alice Garrett, who references Aldo Leopold's land ethic concept. So talk about the definitions of wilderness and then talk about, you know, what that definition came out of.
Well, she and I have had a lot of debates about that. So Alice Garrett has been in the past and all of and the projects that I've worked on, Fish and Wildlife Service, she has been my main liaison for all of the projects that we've been working on. And in many cases, actually was with me on all of the big expeditions that we launched. So, you know, you look at how I phrased wild, but I often would just use the term wilderness. And I think many people would use the term wilderness without attaching a definition to it. You know, I think that they would look at it and say, well, anything that is, you know, out in nature is wilderness, you know, and I started doing that with Alice quite a bit. I'd be like, oh, we're going to go into the wilderness. And she goes, well, no, this isn't a wilderness. And I said, well, what do you mean? We're out in, you know, we're out in the middle of the Alaskan tundra. This is wilderness. She goes, well, no, wilderness has a legal definition. Now, she's an attorney with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and so has a very unique perspective on what wilderness actually means. But she thinks of and believes that the phrase wilderness really only applies to those areas designated as such. And that is what falls under the Wilderness Act. And the Wilderness Act, I believe, was in 1964 or so. And it was essentially to create almost a deeper level of protection for the area that it designates. And so, for instance, in Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, you have the National Wildlife Refuge, but in the heart of the refuge, where the glaciers are, and sort of in the deep center of it, where the bears and the salmon and the glaciers and all the things that have been happening for, you know, since the beginning of time take place, that is actually not only wildlife refuge, but has an overlapping layer of protection as wilderness. And that's under the Wilderness Act. And that means you can't bring motorized vehicles in there. You can't have any structures that are built in there. You can't even, I believe, fly over it in a helicopter. You can't land in them. If you do want to or you need to, there's a whole nother set of rules and permits and permissions, you know. And so it's just this deeper level of protection, almost in many ways, the ultimate protection for land. And so, you know, I thought it was important to include her essay in the book because as we started this conversation, you know, the system is very complex. And I think that this is such a critical and important designation that plays a role in the protection of our public lands and waters. I forget the exact phrasing of it, but there's a somewhat poetic definition in the act itself that basically refers to people as the visitors, not wilderness. And so the wilderness stays. And the famous word, I would say, that is almost synonymous with wilderness is untrammeled. That is really, by definition, what the Wilderness Act is intending to do, to keep an area untrammeled.
Now, talk a little bit about the marine wildlife refuges. Obama opened a major one in Hawaii before he left office. And so talk about the marine sanctuaries and the national monuments. Are they also part of this system? And their role in protecting the oceans in a time of pollution, acidification, and plastic.
No, absolutely. They're critical areas to be protected. And, you know, they are quite large, but they are the minimum size required to, it's scientifically stated as required to sustain a healthy ecosystem. And Obama actually expanded the marine monument in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. So it was actually George W. Bush who created the monument initially, Papahanaumokuakea, and that's a marine national monument about 1,200 miles northwest of Hawaii. And the most famous of those islands is Midway Atoll from the famed Battle of Midway in World War II. And President Obama expanded Papahanaumokuakea at the end of his administration, which we were actually, my work was actually a part of that expansion. They used it on the White House page. I was very proud of that moment of being able to support his announcement and his visit to Midway when he went out there. And, you know, those islands are extremely important, you know, but also the surrounding marine area is vital to the health of sea turtles and spinner dolphins. And there's just so much life there. And seabirds, of course. There are 5 marine national monuments. And so you may ask, well, wait, I thought we were talking about national wildlife refuges. The land areas are national wildlife refuges, and then the greater area of protection on these are marine national monuments, and it's yet another designation. And similar to the Wilderness Act, it's an Antiquities Act designation, but you know, regardless of the fine details of its designation, they protect areas that most people, I don't think, would realize are part of our public lands and water system. We think of the national parks. We rarely think of the oceanic areas. You know, we obviously have the Everglades and Dry Tortugas and Biscayne down in Florida. And, you know, we have the National Park of American Samoa. But otherwise, when you think of the refuge system and the marine national monuments, we have 3 monuments that are coral atolls, ancient coral atolls, rings of coral that formed over submerged volcanoes that have become one of the best places in the Pacific Ocean for wildlife to thrive. And you're talking, you know, schools of fish and abundance of sharks. You know, Palmyra Atoll is another one where the Nature Conservancy has a research station and it shares the management of that area with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the refuge system. But these places are incredible. And you're talking about massive, massive reefs and, you know, millions of seabirds that rely on these islands. I mean, one island I went to, Rose Atoll Marine National Monument, it's only 16 acres. You can walk around it in about 15 minutes. But it represents a critical link to the National Park of American Samoa. I think it's something like 85% of all nesting seabirds in American Samoa go to Rose Atoll to nest. Sea turtles are born there and then travel thousands of miles away to Fiji and other places. They're just these hearts of the ocean that life is attracted to because there's so little land out there, you know, and so little shallow water that they become, you know, these beacons for wildlife. And all of them are uninhabited islands, permanently uninhabited islands, and more or less, I believe, are all closed to visitation because of their protected status. So, you know, they're very prominently featured in the book, as is Alaska, because those two areas combine represent the vast majority by acreage of what the National Wildlife Refuge System comprises.
You mentioned there are five of them. The only one that's off the Atlantic Ocean, where I live in on the east end of Long Island, the Trump administration, in one of its, you know, I think hundreds of actions to deregulate and, you know, all kinds of environmental protections, opened it up to industrial fishing. Tell us the status of that. Is industrial fishing going forward? Can his rule be rolled back? And what do we need to do to make sure that happens?
That's a great question. So when I had just gotten back from the last National Wildlife Refuge, and the Trump administration had announced that they were going to try and roll back marine national monuments. And they mentioned the three that are coral atolls, but two of them, one is the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest part of the ocean. And it's been visited, I think, by only two or three people. James Cameron, I forget who the, was it Cousteau, I think, wasn't it? Who was one of them the first? I could be wrong about that. And then I think Sylvia Earle also went. But the Marianas Trench, you can only visit that in a deep submersible. And more people have been on the moon than have been there. Then, as you said, Northeast Canyons and Seamounts, which is the only marine national monument in the Atlantic. And that also requires a deep submersible. It's considered submerged lands. And it has all these incredible vents and like sea vents. And they're making discoveries all the time. You know, we're living in the age of where everyone's talking about viruses. Well, all these new medicines and things are coming out of these places. We're making new discoveries. They're playing a huge role in our future of healthcare. And so they're very important that they are protected. So when we got back, we find out that the administration wants to downsize or is reviewing all of the monuments, including places like Bear's Ears, which is the most famous of them, and looking at whether they can be exploited for commercial fishing or the energy industry or whatnot. And you know, they're hard because they're kind of indefensible places. You know, they don't have populations of people living there who are going to say, well, no, don't ruin our home. You know, don't ruin our recreation opportunities the way that a place like Bear's Ears might benefit from in Utah. And so you have less of a defensible population for these places. And so they sort of become easy targets. And as of today, the only one that has really had any true rollbacks is the one that you mentioned, Northeast Canyons and Seamounts in the Atlantic, and it was open to commercial fishing. You know, the status is that is what it is right now. My guess is that there will probably be a considerable effort to reverse that with the new administration, and that hopefully and simultaneously, you know, the threats and attacks on the other marine areas will also go away.
Well, as you point out in the book, Ian Scheive, In Refuge, America's Wildest Places, or someone points out in the book in one of the essays, that it's hard to protect something. And once it's unprotected, it's gone. What has been the impact of industrial fishing in the North Mariana?
Northeast Canyons. You know, I'm not exactly sure. You know, the rollback was not all that long ago in the big scheme of things. And I think, if anything, you know, the pandemic has probably slowed impacts because of the inability of a lot of ships and things to go out. And so there hasn't been a huge amount of time. I don't think it was like immediately we're going to open it to drilling the way the Arctic is, for instance, which is yet another attack that the administration has continued to make and is rushing through as they leave office. But to my knowledge, I don't believe that there has been, you know, an immediate or irreconcilable damage. But again, I'm not 100% privy to, you know, the current legal status of it and you know, what may be possible for commercial fishing that could cause damage in the future.
So the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, as you just said, Trump, and, you know, he's going to do as much damage as he possibly can to our environment and succeeding generations before he leaves office. Just briefly tell us what the impact would be if this is allowed to go forward. And I understand there is a fight against this. How robust are the defenses that we can marshal against it?
Well, I think the defenses are robust. You know, the one thing I will say is there are an awful lot of really incredible organizations out there working around the clock for mounting a legal defense on this. So there's a little bit of a backstory on Arctic from me, it's because it's a bit of a personal thing, is I didn't realize it, but the first refuge I ever heard of as a kid was Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And back then, no one referred to it as Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It was always ANWR. And I remember seeing pictures of it in the, you know, in the paper, National Geographic and things like that, and being really mesmerized by the beauty of it. But sadly, the reason everyone was always talking about it was because it was being challenged to be drilled for oil, you know, energy exploitation. And so that's how I learned about Arctic. And I remember as I got older and my love of photography and nature grew that I had always really wanted to go. And it was sort of the dream of like, God, the Arctic. I mean, the Arctic is, I think, for anybody who is sort of into exploration and adventure, is one of the big ones to have an opportunity to go and see, wherever it may be, but getting inside the Arctic Circle. But inside the refuge itself is when I finally got to go, was just so mesmerizingly wild and beautiful. And, you know, I was there in autumn too, when all of the tundra is changing into reds and golds, and you'd see a grizzly bear go running through, or, you know, herds of caribou. I mean, it was just unbelievable how peaceful of a place it really is. And ultimately, it became the cover of my new book, Refuge, America's Wildest Places, for all of those reasons, because it was the first one I had heard of. And it's the one that it's been more than 40 years, they have been trying to open it to oil exploitation. And, you know, I'm 42 years old, so almost my entire life, and it might have been even longer than that, but at least it goes back as far as I can remember. And it's just one of those places that just keeps getting hammered on. And I ask myself, what does it really take? What does it mean to protect a place if it's not truly protected? And if a legal battle can go on for 40 years, then there must be enough of a reason, a compelling reason and common sense to say that this is a place that has to be put aside. And it doesn't take a genius to look at the photos and look at this place. And anybody who I think would spend more than 10 minutes there would absolutely see the value of a place like Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So for me, it is so disheartening to know that it continues to be battled, but it is not surprising that this current administration has tried to take everything down with it. And Arctic is just one of those places. It is one of the many things that I think the American public has suffered from this administration. And the fact that it continues to be attacked is not a surprise because of the history of it. It's hugely dismaying because we clearly see countries going 100% sustainable all the time now. And we should be focused on the future and moving off of fossil fuels. I mean, inevitably, you know, we do use them and you know, they are part of our lives, but we could be working away from them, and we shouldn't be destroying the places that we've already protected in the process of doing that. And so it seems as though that this will get opened to drilling. Again, you know, it's so hard to tell because I don't think we've really ever seen this kind of attack on America before at the very end of an administration. And so with, you know, whatever, how many days left, you know, what does that really mean for these kinds of attacks from a legal standpoint? But there are incredible organizations. There's also incredible groups. Of course, the indigenous peoples of the Arctic, the Gwich'in, you know, they've all created a defense, you know, through the Arctic Defense Council. And so they are hopefully going to continue to hammer back, and hopefully the Arctic will remain as is.
Yes. And on that hopeful note, and we should note also that Biden has specifically mentioned that, as I believe, sure, as one of the things he's going to work on. And let's also not forget, actually, that there's not a whole lot of interest in drilling in the Arctic.
No, there's really not. I mean, it's, you know, there's not a huge amount to gain. I mean, and I've been to the, you know, so one of the big arguments of people who are proponents of drilling in the Arctic say, well, every time I see a picture of a mountain and caribou and these, you know, and these rivers and everything, that's not the Arctic that's we're talking about. That's not the Arctic that's going to be drilled. We're going to drill up here and there's nothing there. It's tracked 1002, I believe. And I've been to tracked 1002. And I can tell you, I have seen it. And it is filled with polar bears. It is a stunning piece of land. And we have to think of our environment and conservation of nature as an interconnected piece, you know, an interconnected world. You know, we can't just say, well, let's protect this piece here and forget this piece over there. And the more we've learned about nature, we learn that You know, the interconnectedness of all of these things is what is driving the health of our planet. And so, you know, even from an early age, when I first started shooting in Montana, I learned about the Yellowstone to Yukon initiative and the idea of having wildlife corridors, because wildlife would move from Yellowstone all the way north into the Yukon and then back. And the Arctic is very similar. And the other thing is, it's like, they say, well, it's clean and it's easy and it won't, you know, we won't cause any damage. We've all heard that before. How many times have we seen the pipe break or the deep water platform explode? And, you know, next thing you know, you're seeing yet another catastrophic impact on nature.
Ian Shive, this is a stunningly beautiful book and has a lot of information in it, in essays. You know, they're short essays, short and sweet. Each one adds more to it. It's Refuge, America's Wildest Places, and it's just been such a pleasure to talk with you about it.
It's a pleasure to speak with you as well. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share the National Wildlife Refuge system with people through this book. So I really hope everyone enjoys it as much as I have enjoyed making it.
Ian Shive is an Ansel Adams Award-winning photographer, filmmaker, author, and environmentalist. Go to writersvoice.net to see some of the photos in Refuge. And head over to writersvoice.net also to hear the extended version of the interviews we aired today. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.